in the system. You can get pretty dry and sluggish when we just sit all the time. And so this section on the four postures is, I think, the implicit in that is a recommendation to practice in all four postures. And there's good reason for it. Certainly, it's some of what we pointed to earlier, that there's a lot less distraction when you're sitting still with your eyes closed, and then when you get up and move about, there's a lot more going on. And one wants to be able to sustain this experience of relaxed awareness, sort of a centeredness in the midst of activity. And that is kind of up in the ante, if you will, on practice. So there's that part to it, and there's the energy that it arouses. But it also has to be said that there's a great potential for insight written into this section on practicing in all four postures, standing, seated, walking, and lying down. And that is, you know, just going back to that question about pain and when to move and when not to move, there's, they say that one of the biggest obstacles to insight into dukkha is constantly changing postures without noticing. It's more a case of just constantly fidgeting and fussing and trying to get away from pain. And as long as we keep that up, well, we won't see dukkha. You have to turn towards it. You have to settle into it, relax around it, if you will. And so mindfulness, not only in the four postures, but as we change postures, is potentially a key player for seeing that, for seeing the truth of dukkha and impermanence, because there is this constant changing throughout the day. We don't even notice it. And also there's potential for insight into non-self, you know, partly because, you know, you can't watch this movement, changing of postures, or just attend to the what's going on as you go back and forth in walking meditation. You can't do that for very long and not somehow have it register that we're not doing this. This is operating according to its own laws. The movement happens. Yes, there's an impulse from the mind, and we might think we're the mind, but even that is suspect. So just looking and seeing how there's great potential here for insight into non-self as well. And any time that there is a drifting within the walking, you look and see there's some issue that's come into the mind that has self-concern written all over it. And that's where the mind is going. It's going to self-concern instead of staying with the simple reality of being a human being who's sitting and breathing, who's standing and breathing, who's walking and breathing, and is aware of it. Very different experience. So we keep noticing and trust that, you know, over time, just this, we reach a critical mass of data and you sort of get it in one way or another, that this system is pretty much operating itself, but there is a knowing awareness within it. And that gives us the capacity to awaken within it. So contemplating Dhamma, contemplating what we're seeing, what we're experiencing, is very much a part of the meditation practice, the foundations of mindfulness. Contemplating the Dhamma in everything that we see and experience. So it's time to get some nourishment, have some lunch, and maybe a rest if you need it, or a little walk. Best thing is just to sort of discern what's going on, where are you, what's needed at this time. If you want to spread a couple of mats out and have a little nap, feel free to do that. We'll ring to signal the time to come back together at 1:30. And this is sometimes these periods that are unstructured, the mind has a way of kind of putting them outside the retreat. You know, this is a break. you don't have to practice with this. This is break time. And yet, you know, the Buddha very clearly points us our attention to these kinds of times as well. There's this whole section in the Satipatthana Sutta that I call the 24/7 section, you know, where one acts in full awareness. And this is how he puts it. One acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, when flexing and extending the limbs, when wearing the robes and carrying the outer robe and bowl, when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, when defecating and urinating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. Pretty much covers the whole range of human activity. And you know, when you first maybe come to this, if you're like me, I was like, oh man, you know, I got to pay attention all the time now, you know, and I can't even pee in peace, you know. Somebody's got to be paying attention, you know. And fair enough, it can feel like that. But really, nothing has changed. He's still talking about relaxing and knowing what's happening. Can you feel that? Nothing's different. All that's different is that you're doing it with increased activity, in the experience of more activity in our lives. So the key thing, so that the mind doesn't hunch up and start to think I have to practice with this, you know, is to just keep relaxing, relaxing, and preparing your food, eating the food, discerning when it is that you're full, putting it away, using the toilet if you need to, going for a walk, all of that. Just enjoy it, really. You know, in a relaxed state, it's infinitely more enjoyable. And when you're just knowing what's happening, one is able to make wiser choices. You know, but if it's all sort of on automatic pilot, you don't. It's like wisdom doesn't get a say. You know, it's just driven. So use it in this way. Use this period from now until 1:30 when we gather again in this way. And it could be quite pleasant. Very hard to get to direct knowledge, direct experience, and yet what you're up against is a habit of the mind that seems to want to do everything but that. It just goes on and on about things and takes. If we go with it, if we don't see it as such and be able to stand back from it and watch it phenomenologically, then, you know, the end result or the net result is that we're rarely here. We're rarely actually in our experience. We're in our heads about what's going on much of the time. And it's painful. It's a painful state to live in, not to mention the fact that in order to garner the insights of insight meditation, we can't be caught up in that. We have to be sitting outside of it and watching it and learning about how the mind operates. So if we don't see it or learn to work with it skillfully, then we just get easily stuck in these one-sided perspectives and even incorrect views about what's going on. And that actually becomes our world. That's where we live, much if not most of the time, in our heads. And I think for me, the real danger I began to see runs even deeper, which is that this is all happening at what, I don't know, for want of a better language or terminology for it, I just say, I call it the superficial layers of the mind, the surface layers of the mind. It's like these are sentiments and feelings and ideas that don't run very deep. You know, it's like, oh, I like that, I don't like that, oh, that's great, that. You know, it's all kind of just busyness, you know, noise in the mind. And yet that's, again, where we spend so much of our time. So we're settling, if you will, for a life experience that is superficial by definition, necessarily so. And we're trying to get ourselves to a place of a much more profound reality as meditators. And so maybe you've met people who are completely or utterly lost in their views. Maybe you've been that way yourself sometimes, you know. And you can see how what that's like and what it sets up in terms of how you're relating to yourself, how we're relating interpersonally. It's very painful stuff. And if you take it on as a practice just to begin to notice these patterns, it's fascinating to see what the views are about. I mean, some of them, they aren't even about things that matter, you know? Like, you can get into fights over how to mount the toilet paper on the toilet paper roll, you know? Or which way the paper towels go, or do you leave the butter out at night or put it back in the refrigerator? This kind of stuff. And really, I mean, I've talked with people enough about practice and about relationships to see some of this stuff is the stuff that breaks up marriages, you know? It's like, you know, you've got to be kidding here. So there's some way that we've got to see this and learn to work with it a lot more skillfully. Because if we're stuck in it, then when things go our way, we're okay. When they don't go our way, we're suffering. And add to that the further complexity that we actually think it's the behavior of other people, the situation, the condition in the world out there that is the reason why we're suffering. If they would just do it my way, you know, the way that the right way, then everything would be all right, you know? It's such delusion. And, I mean, I guess that's the bad news. You can get caught in that and be in that a lot. But the good news is that if we understand this and learn to work with it skillfully, then it puts the possibility of freedom from the suffering that centers around all this squarely in our hands, it makes it very doable. You know, if the world's got to change for us to be happy, you know, we're in deep doo-doo. But if there's a way that we can change the way that we are in relation to people and situations, then there's a real possibility, not only for moment-to-moment happiness, but for awakening this mind. So, I mean, this is powerful stuff, you know, when you contemplate what the Buddha's pointing to here. So I don't know about you, but it really gets my attention. And I think it's because, you know, I found it very painful to live in a contracted, biased, opinionated mind. You know, it feels like, as I began to watch this, it just began to feel like I was just seized up all the time. You know, I don't like that. Don't want that to be that way. You know, that kind of feeling. But fortunately, it's a very, very rich area for practice. I think I said in the first time we got together that contemplation of this aggregate, the sanya aggregate, or the sanya khanda. So what we do as practitioners just highlight this activity of the mind and see how easily we can get caught up in views, see how the mind does that. It's a very impersonal process. It's what the mind does. It's not who we are. There's no fault here or blame here. It's just a highly conditioned habit of the mind. Just pay attention to the consequences of doing that. Pay attention to what it feels like, you know, how we so want communion and connection with people, and we're constantly forming ideas that separate us out from each other. and living in those perspectives. And just pay attention too to what it feels like in those moments when we're not doing that. It's so much freer and happier state. So obviously there's a lot of areas where one forms views, but three I think stand out. And one has to do with political and social arena, you know, views and perspectives about the world around us. The people, the closest people in our lives, the intimate relationships, our nearest and dearest, and perhaps most deadly in many ways and most difficult are the views that we have about ourselves and how we live, how we form these views and get locked into them. And here we are trying to break out of our own suffering. So just the reason why I point these out is because they're everyday occurrences and they're everyday situations and there are everyday suffering. These are the areas where we get hooked and get caught up. So I mean, there's no shortage of things to talk about in the whole political arena. I don't want to go into it too much because it's very very obvious, especially in this country in the last few years, what attachment to views can do and how entrenched those views can become and how people can get so locked in that they cannot or will not see another perspective. You know, the whole idea of democracy and debate and mutual respect for one another's perspective and coming together and negotiating is just out the window. And I thought it was very interesting to read one of the things the Buddha said about this. I thought, boy, he's just really characterizing the contemporary situation in our political system. He says, "One immersed in views has clearly not arisen above disputes. When he sees advantage for himself in what is heard, thought, or practiced, he seizes upon and grasps that. He sees everything else as inferior. This is what the skillful call a fetter." You know, and it's basically an attachment, a difficult state of mind. So, you know, if you watch all of this meditatively and try not to get pulled in, which is a huge thing, isn't it? You know, just but try it and watch what happens. You know, the whole system can feel nauseated. You know, just as you touch the contracted state of polarities meeting up against each other and each trying to gain center stage, you know, each convinced that their perspective is the right perspective. You know, and I've certainly seen it. It's like, and I'll bet this is true for you, you know, over the years, just like alternately getting irritated with the whole thing, wishing it would stop being that way and demanding that they stop being the way that they are and then beginning to realize, well, wait a minute, I'm doing the same thing, you know. So you can see how you get pulled in to the whole view-making and counter-view-making process very easily. You know, sometimes it can feel that the stakes are so high that, you know, one has to do that. And so you got that on one hand, and then on the other hand, the tendency to just go, sick of the whole mess, leave it to the 30-somethings. I did my bit, you know, it's their turn, I'm done with it, you know. And you know, that's not a remedy either. One doesn't want to do that either, you know. So we do what we can, and just whatever little corner of it we feel we can influence, we do. But more recently, in the last few years, I've taken a completely different tack on it all, which is to begin to notice, you know, forget about Congress and the whole political system, just to begin to notice how I am relating to the people in my life who have different political views than I have, you know. And it's been so rich. It's been very, very powerful. Because, you know, I live in the South, and everybody around me virtually is very conservative politically, and I'm giving away my own politics, but that's okay. I don't tend to be that way. And so here I am In the summertime particularly, but certainly throughout the year, I like to get exercise first thing in the morning, and I do that in the water, in the pool. And so I found myself in this new place I've been living in the last 7 years, just going to the pool, right out of bed, you know, get your bathing suit on, go over. And lo and behold, over the time of doing that, there's a lot of other people who are early risers and get over there right away. You know, sometimes before the sun's even up, we're in the water. And we do our water aerobics and we do our laps, and there's always this social aspect to it, you know. So then they start talking about their views and about Obama this and health care, you know, affordable health care that, and defense of marriage, that, you know, and then what the conservative pundits are saying, you know, and just reiterating the party line. I mean, just going in with it over and over and over. And so for the longest time, I've just had to, you know, just bite my tongue and take a deep breath and, you know, try to talk myself through what I'm feeling, you know, because it's painful. And one wants to say something, but these are my neighbors, you know. And you're clearly outnumbered, so, you know, it's not like you're coming from a strong position, you know. And so I even had the thought at one point, I just need to find another time to swim, you know. And I caught myself doing that, you know, because it's like my adolescent mind, you know. I don't like you. I'm not going to swim with you, you know. That kind of stuff. And I don't want to be caught in that either. So, you know, I was just noticing all of that. And, you know, when the thing is, they would know, they knew that I didn't share those views. And yet they would always be putting them out there. And so I said, well, that's a good place to start. I can at least point that out to them, you know. You know, they don't have to abandon their views, but I could ask them to be a little more considerate, you know, or something like that. And so I did, and it really worked. It went well, you know, that they were able to go, oh, yeah, oh, I'm sorry, you know. And I began to realize through that, the way that they were reacting to my request, that, you know, you're zeroing in on a very small part of who these people are, you know. Is that what you want to do? And then just start to pan back and notice all of them, you know. And these are very, very good and kind people, very community-minded, very much looking out for each other. This one's sick, so everybody, they make an agenda, who's going to take the meal this day, who's going to take the meal that day, and who's going to take her to the hospital, and all that. Or, you know, I need to get to the airport, and there's three or four of them offering to take me, you know, this kind of stuff. And I thought, you know, you got to look at this, you know. This is not the person. This is a view. And can we pan back and open the heart enough to be able to embody the whole of the person? Ever since, you know, I have a way to go, definitely. I bet we all do, but making that my practice, you know, forget about the political rightness and wrongness of different polarities. Let's just find a way to tolerate each other's views, you know. I want to be respectful of different perspectives. Man, yeah, that's hard if you're attached to perception. That's hard to do, you know? So something's got to give here if the objective is kindness and tolerance and respectful relationships. And so that's how I'm working with it. I'd certainly look to hear how you're working with it. And just to lose the idea of the view. Anytime there's a view and you try to counter that with another view, watch, that's part of what I saw in this process. You know, it's just as entrenched and just as much a setup for a battlefield as anything, you know. And so just really trying to work with it that way. And, you know, but also just in the final analysis, recognizing that we're not talking about becoming doormats. We're not talking about not speaking up when people are being hurtful or inconsiderate. You know, just really trying to do that as well and learning how to do it. And so slowly our conversations, anyway, have become more neutral and even humorous. You know, don't go there. Gloria hates that stuff. Don't do that, you know. And we can laugh together about it, you know. They can. There's other arenas where they can argue like that, you know. They don't have to do it in the presence of somebody who they know disagrees or holds things differently. So that's one perspective and one area. And but the views also play a very important role in how we're relating to one another in our friendships and in our family relationships. I'm sure you've seen this. And they really condition the way that we think about each other, the way that we see each other, and how we relate. It doesn't take long in a significant relationship, a marriage, or a partnership, or families, or just close friends to start to characterize people in our minds and see them through that characterization. Instead of remaining open. I'm not saying this is easy, and there's always this side of it, but they pretty much are that way, so, you know, isn't there some truth to it? Well, yes, and no, you know, it has to be held in a broader way. So it's very easy to have images of people and to hang on to these and in subtle and not so subtle ways. And the thing is that over time, soon the image replaces the person, and you're not with each other as we are in that moment, because we aren't always a certain way. You know, the view will make us that way, but we aren't always that way. And if we can hold it in this more open way, that's a much greater potential for harmony in relationships. And I think one of the big things that we have to come to grips with is that people, even our close, nearest and dearest, don't see things the way that we see them. You know, it's kind of like it's a big surprise somehow, which is it's boggling to me. You know, you stand back and you look around the world and see how many billions of people we are, or millions or billions, I don't even know the world population, but and virtually everyone is different. Right? And yet this mind can come up with an idea that there's a way that we should be. You know, it's amazing. And get stuck in that very, very easily. I have a good friend who's very much like that. I think I may have told some of you this story before, but it's such a good example, where she has a certain way that she wants things done in her household. And she drives her partner and her daughter nuts with it, you know. But she gets to say how it gets done. It's just always been that way in her mind, you know. No, we have to do it this way, you know. Whether it's how you're cutting the carrots for the lentil soup, or how the cups are going to be stored in the cupboard, or how you're going to fold the towels in the linen closet, or any of it, you know. It's a very, very strict and specific way that things need to be done. Obviously, you know, good luck. It doesn't always play out that way, does it? So they, but they're all practitioners, her partner and her daughter, and so they've talked about it and came up with a really good solution, because she was driving them nuts, you know, and she was driving herself nuts as she began to see it. So they got her a tiara. And they put it. She was especially this way in the kitchen, and they named it, and they said, you know, she's in her queen of the kitchen mode. And so whenever she's in, recognizes that she's in that mode, or they see it and she's not seeing it, you know, whoever, somebody has to put the tiara on her head, you know, and then it's like it's out in the open, you know. I'm in my attachment to review mode, this is the way it should be. And then they all have a good laugh. And sometimes, I mean, they've really worked it out beautifully. Sometimes she has to yield and stop doing that. You're driving us nuts, you know. And sometimes they have to yield. Say, okay, we'll do it. You're the queen of the kitchen today. You know, you tell us what to do and we'll do it, you know. And it's great. I mean, it works very well. And I've done that myself a lot at the monasteries because I live alone. I don't get the opportunity to interact like this on a daily basis. So the place where I get my hits is at the monasteries, where you're living cheek by jowl with a couple dozen other people who are from all different countries, you know, speak all different languages and have all different personalities, and you're thrown into this pressure cooker and told to get along, you know. It's like, oh no, it's a prescription for difficulty, you know. But there you are, and you have to work it out. That's why I love going there, and this container can hold it. It can help us work it out, because the aspiration within it is kindness and civility and getting along. And so it happens there all the time. And I would watch how, you know, maybe somebody's new and doesn't realize about community life. And so there's one bathroom for 8 women in the morning, and most of us are getting up 20 minutes before we've got to get to puja, you know. And she's in there for 15 of those minutes, you know. And you're going, ah! you just can't leave things around. You can't leave the toothpaste and your toothbrush laying on the sink. They get all mixed up. It's not hygienic, you know. You can't, if you're going to have a cup of tea, you've got to wash the cup out and put it back. I mean, you know, there's just too many people. You can't be behaving like that. So, you know, in the early years of going there, this was brutal for my mind. You know, this is unconscionable. You know, this, people are so inconsiderate. They should know better. Don't they know that I'm here and that, you know, this is the rules in the monastery and they're hurting me, you know, or all these kinds of reactive patterns would come up. You know, I don't want them to be the way that they are, because it's interfering with my life. And you could feel very justified in it, because there's a way that it should be, because we're at the monastery, you know. There's rules. And yet nobody really tells you what the rules are. Nobody says don't leave your toothbrush on the sink. You're just expected to sort of become attuned to it. It could become attuned to the rhythm of living together. And over time, hopefully people do. But I could easily write it off and say, well, you know, I just have to put up with it for a month. You know, I don't live with them, I'm, you know. And you can come away easily feeling, even in the midst of it, even while you're right up against it, that you really are right and they're really wrong, you know. And you can go through the whole period of living together and you know, applaud the day when they leave and think that your torment is over, you know. But the habit of being locked into a view about how things should be, how people should be, is still there. You know, so you haven't conquered anything. You know, the one, and this is what the Buddha, I think, is pointing to. We want to be able to see this, see where the suffering actually is. Is it in the coffee cup on the counter? Is it in the toothpaste being left out? You know, where's the suffering? Yeah, and again, it puts it squarely back in the domain of where you can actually do something about it. You know, so if we pay attention, as we do as practitioners, then all this tendency to view making takes a real beating, and you want it to, you know, you want to be able to see what the mind is doing and what attachment to that is doing to us. I mean, we're the ones who are suffering. They don't even, half the time, most of the time, the other people don't even know we're doing it. Don't even know how much we're suffering because they are the way that they are, you know, and we think they shouldn't be. It's quite amazing. So just, you know, looking and seeing that anything that pits one perspective, one view, one idea against another, by the Buddhist definition, is suffering. And we're the ones that are suffering. And so we learn over time it's better to surrender, even to other people's way of doing things. And that can sound, I've said that in some circles, people don't like that, you know. I mean, even if they're being thoughtless, even if they're being inconsiderate, to surrender to the way that they are. But that's my practice, to allow the people to be the way that they are.